From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Paul Brandis, White House reporter for West Wing Reports and columnist for Dow Jones and USA Today. Joining me on the panel this week via Skype are Kimberly Adams. She's correspondent for Marketplace, and Tom DeFrank. He's contributing editor to National Journal. And here are this week's issues. The coronavirus death toll continues to rise around the world. Some 300,000 deaths so far. This as countries debate about how, when, and even whether to reopen parts of the economy. The global economy continues to reel from the virus. The head of America's central bank warns that the downturn could get even worse. We'll also discuss efforts in India, Africa, and elsewhere to contain the virus. That debate is fierce here in the United States, which now leads the world in confirmed cases and deaths. That virus, by the way, has now made its way into the heart of the White House. Also here in America, a federal judge has moved to block efforts by the Trump administration to drop the case against former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. And America's highest court, the Supreme Court, is weighing whether Congress can force the president to turn over his financial records. Well, let's start with this coronavirus. As I mentioned, nearly 4.5 million cases worldwide, some 300,000 deaths, and a vaccine still seems months away at best. And yet some countries are taking preliminary steps to reopen their economies. For example, in China, where all this began, the big Disney resort in Shanghai is open, and the world's biggest hotel company, Marriott, now says the worst may be over. Just two examples here. Kimberly, let's start with you. This debate over reopening businesses, getting people back to work, perfectly understandable, but also understandable are concerns about people's safety. How do you kind of balance those two very real concerns?
Well, it's really kind of how each individual person balances those concerns, because businesses can decide to open if their state decides that they should be allowed, if the federal government loosens guidelines. What we're really talking about is the individual concerns that people have about their own personal safety and what they may or may not be willing to subject themselves to. Now, in the United States, of course, there is a political divide on this. There's been a lot of research coming out in the last week or so indicating that how worried you are about coronavirus really depends on where you live and honestly what kind of media you're consuming. Me personally, when I was in Washington, D.C., which is where I live, everyone's wearing masks. People are doing their social distancing. Lots of people are very worried. But I'm right now in St. Louis, Missouri, where many people aren't wearing masks. I'm seeing lots of people hanging out with each other. Businesses are getting ready to reopen on Monday, and people are planning to go out. And it really is very different depending on where you are in America and what you're thinking about. Now, when it comes to individual businesses, there is a concern about whether or not businesses are going to be liable for either their workers getting sick or people getting sick at their locations. And Congress is looking at that, and lawyers are already talking about that because there have been a few cases about business liability working their way through the system.
You know, Tom, leading the charge to reopen is President Trump. But, you know, there are now confirmed cases of this virus in the White House itself, people who are quite close to the president. How can he urge people to go back to work when even his own workplace does not appear to be safe?
Well, it's a bit of a conundrum for the president. Of course, Paul, you're right about that. His argument is that he and his closest associates are tested every day. Even at the moment, he and Vice President Mike Pence are separated physically for the most part, because Pence's press secretary came down with the virus. He tested negative for several days and then tested positive. And when the president had a press conference in the Rose Garden a few days ago, everybody except himself was wearing a mask. The fact is that the White House the treatment is almost absolute. He is surrounded by people, and the medical unit there takes care of everybody, tests constantly, but it raises the question, how can anyone be confident that you're going to be safe if the epicenter of the United States government, the White House, is popping up with a handful of cases?
And he's been unable to answer a question that has been put to him a couple of times now. You know, everybody in the White House, as you mentioned, there's testing when you go in, and the president and people around him are tested constantly. And yet it's been said by his new press secretary that, well, testing for Americans on a widespread basis is, in the word that she used, was nonsensical. How is it logical to do this widespread testing in the White House, but not logical to do it elsewhere?
Probably because there are fewer number of individuals that you have to test. To have a much expanded testing program in the United States, you're going to have to test millions and millions and millions of people more or less constantly every day. That's a lot of people. That's a lot of expense. And to be very blunt about it, the testing, whether you think testing is warranted or not, a lot more testing will show a lot more cases of individuals who either haven't the virus and show no symptoms, or had it and are now immune. And so all those numbers will add to the totals, and there are some in the White House who don't want to risk those sorts of totals. I am not saying the White House is playing politics here. I am saying that political calculations about testing and about reopening states, there have some validity. There are political calculations and political consequences, and you can't believe otherwise.
In the meantime, and this is for you, I think, Kimberly, Dr. Anthony Fauci is arguably the best known medical official in the United States, certainly highly respected. He is urging caution. He testified before the Senate a couple of days ago on video, said that reopening the economy too soon will lead to, and I'm quoting here, he said, suffering and death that could be avoided. What do you think of that?
You know, it's very interesting in that hearing. Dr. Fauci was very careful to say, he's like, look, I'm not here to make economic projections about what is and isn't good for the economy. I'm here to talk about what's going to happen to public health. And he said, you know, yes, without widespread testing, without isolation, without good contact tracing, you know, yes, we are going to see a spike in cases and suffering. And he was really pushed on what that means for the economy. And we keep hearing this choice that may or may not be a realistic one between opening the economy versus public health. You know, there's a solid criticism to be made that's a false choice to begin with. But right now that is the narrative that's being discussed, because the economy is struggling mightily right now. And people are also stir crazy. And so you mentioned the White House's testing regime, but in many ways that's sort of being used probably as an example. And there's a solid argument to be made that this is a false choice between public health and reopening the economy. But there is at least a correlation between some of the economic, you know, trauma we're experiencing and the isolation, the lockdowns, the social distancing, and all of these new restrictions. But individuals, states, communities, and the federal government in many ways are having to make this choice. And I think what Dr. Fauci is pointing out is that we are not going to be able to get solid control of this pandemic without the widespread testing, without the contact tracing, without some of these other measures that the health officials have laid out. And there just does not seem to be the political will coming out of the White House, or in many cases coming out of the states, to do that. And so what you have now is, while Congress is working on separately, the House and the Senate, their next ideas for another round of stimulus, there does seem to be a bit of a wait and see approach. Mitch McConnell in the Senate wants to see what happens when these states reopen, to see how much more stimulus and what kind is needed. Speaker Pelosi even said the other day, the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, said that she doesn't really have the data yet to see what the stimulus funding thus far has really done and whether or not it's been a boost to the economy. You know, there's a whole lot of unknowns when it comes to the economy, and really still a lot of unknowns when it comes to the health pandemic.
So there's no clear roadmap here, obviously, and you've got Dr. Fauci kind of erring on the side of caution here. But then, as Kimberly has pointed out, the economic pain is quite severe. The latest batch of people filing for unemployment claims, about 3 million more in the past week. So that's about 36 million Americans, I believe, who have now filed for unemployment. So the pain is getting worse, and yet we don't quite have the political will, it seems, Tom, to really do anything until we figure out, just how effective has this aid been so far? You described that as a conundrum, and that sounds exactly what it's like, right?
But it's a dangerous game. Those who are pushing reopening are playing. They're basically saying, let's see how this goes and see what happens to the numbers. Well, already cases of the virus are going up in many of the states that have begun opening up, partially at least. And there are also evidence that in certain parts of the country, in the Midwest and the West, that have not had much of incidences at all, suddenly there are cases. And the doctors and the specialists would say, well, that's because those states have begun relaxing the social distancing, relaxing rules. And we will have to see. Even the president a few days ago said he disagrees with Dr. Fauci on the question of whether you reopen schools too soon. President wants schools reopened with one caveat. President is saying, well, if you're a teacher or a professor more over 60 years old, maybe you ought to sit it out for a while, which raises the question of if you're a worker anywhere over 60 or 65 years old, should you be going back to work? And what is that message that is sent to the businesses trying to figure out whether you should come back to work or not? The problem is, I think we would be addressing this a little differently if the next presidential election were a year instead of 5 months away this November.
Let's pause for a short break. More Issues in the News in just a moment. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you'd like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on VOA's website at voanews.com. Now back to our panel via Skype. Kimberly Adams, she's the correspondent for Marketplace. She's joining us from St. Louis, Missouri. And Tom DeFrank, he's contributing editor to National Journal. Kimberly, you know, we've been talking about the United States here, which is sadly the epicenter of this crisis, but obviously this virus is all over the world. In India, Prime Minister Modi plans to spend the equivalent of about a quarter of a trillion U.S. dollars to help India's economy. And there are warnings that hospitals in Africa could be overwhelmed as the virus spreads there. Your thoughts on that?
You know, it's going to be, to put it quite bluntly, terrifying to see how this disease spreads in places like India and in parts of sub-Saharan Africa in particular, where you really do have people living in very densely populated cities and densely populated areas, and where, you know, just household incomes don't make it quite as easily for people to space out and give themselves a break or even to necessarily purchase their own homemade protective gear. It's going to look very different than it has in Europe and in the United States, where for all of the flaws, we do have more economic resources to throw at this if we so choose to do that. Also, this is coming at the same time that, you know, the United States is withholding some funding from the World Health Organization, which has been underfunded in recent years, and many of the groups that typically might step in to help with these types of things aren't necessarily in the best position to do so. Think about, you know, what happened during the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, you know, some years ago. You had, you know, sort of this global response coming together to go and try to come up with the cure. I don't know that we're going to see the same organized global outreach to go to places where this pandemic might really pick up steam in the way that you did then, because everyone is worried about their own outbreak and probably looking a bit more insular.
And ancillary to that, there have been reports that all kinds of nonprofit organizations, the kinds, as you just explained, who would normally be assisting in parts of third world crisis like this, They are running out of cash, and they're wondering if even they will survive. So any attempts that they could make to respond are going to be, they just don't have the money.
Right, because you also have the donor base eroding a little bit. Sure, you have, you know, these major philanthropic organizations and big funders like Bill Gates just pouring money into these efforts. But, you know, he's looking at trying to find a cure or to speed up a response. And he's asking other multi-billionaires to add in. But if you think about sort of the regular everyday donors to the UNHCR or to the Red Cross or to Mercy Corps or something like that, a lot of these are just regular people who might give a little bit of money per month. Well, when you've got nearing 20% unemployment, other people having their hours cut back here in the United States, and general economic fear of what's coming next, that we're, you know, headed into or already in a recession of an unknown duration, people are a lot more hesitant to donate to these charitable causes. And if they are donating to charity, it's often in their own communities where they can see the pain happening right in front of them.
Well, let's move on. There are things going on beyond this coronavirus. Here in America, for example, a federal judge is moving to block efforts by the Trump administration to drop the case against former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Flynn is a retired general who pled guilty to lying to the FBI. Tom, what did he lie about specifically?
He lied about contacts that he had with the Soviet ambassador Kislyak over a period of several weeks, mainly after the Republican convention in 2016 and during the presidential transition between Obama and Trump, between November 2016 and January 2017. That's what he was accused of lying about, and he pleaded guilty to that, as you pointed out. General Flynn, I believe, is the shortest tenured National Security Advisor ever. He lasted for 24 days, and he was fired by President Trump for allegedly lying to Vice President Mike Pence about these contacts he had with the Russian ambassador. And the allegation was he was saying, don't worry about sanctions between the U.S. and Russia. We're going to take a look at that as soon as candidate Trump has been sworn in as president. And he allegedly lied about that. And again, he pleaded guilty to doing that. But since then, he changed lawyers, and his new lawyer said, you can beat this, and you've got friends at the White House, in essence. And so he has tried to withdraw his guilty plea. In the meantime, Attorney General William Barr has asked the courts to dismiss the charges against him on the grounds that they weren't relevant. As you can imagine, Paul, this has caused quite a legal firestorm in judicial circles.
It's kind of an old phrase here that it's not the crime, it's the cover-up, and Flynn was fired for lying, in other words, trying to cover up what he did. But some people have said, well, why is it so unusual for an incoming national security advisor to talk to the ambassador of another country?
It's not unusual. It's done all the time. The difference here was when he was asked about his contacts, he lied about them to Vice President Pence, which is what got him fired. And then when the FBI started investigating all of this whole subject of alleged Russian help with the Trump campaign, the FBI interviewed General Flynn, and that was when he was later indicted for allegedly lying to the FBI, which is a crime.
Also here in Washington, America's highest court, the Supreme Court, is weighing whether Congress can actually force President Trump to turn over his financial records. This is a big deal because it's been alleged that President Trump's financial records, his tax returns and so forth, may contain secrets about his financial dealings, where he gets his money and so forth, that he would prefer Americans not know about. He's not revealed them for several years here. Kimberly, where's this case going to go in your view?
You know, it was very interesting. First, it should be said that we're in unprecedented times with the Supreme Court in that they're doing their oral arguments remotely, as many of us are working remotely. And so people are able to listen to these oral arguments before the Supreme Court live as they're happening, which is really unusual, but it gives some unique insights a little bit more quickly than we might normally have them. The court is really seems to be separating out these two different ways that lawyers are trying to get at the president's financial records. One way is that Congress, Democrats in Congress want to look at them, and the court is really challenging. Some of the justices are really challenging, you know, how do you draw that line between sort of political harassment almost of an opposing party's leader and sort of searching out records for that reason? Versus, you know, the state of New York that actually has sort of a criminal investigation ongoing and them asking for President Trump's financial records as part of those proceedings, because the court does seem to be a bit more amenable to the idea that, yes, if you're a prosecutor and you're looking for evidence in a criminal trial, that's one thing. But if you're Congress and you're in the opposing party and this is just an investigation that you think might win you some political points or maybe is just good information to have, that's different. And you can really kind of hear the court trying to suss out where these boundaries should be, because the Supreme Court in the United States, when they make a decision, it's not just a decision in that case. It sets a precedent for how courts below them and potentially future Supreme Courts will deal with similar cases in the future.
You know, Tom, it seems to me that the president always calls things like this a witch hunt. That's one of his favorite phrases that he applies to all sorts of things. But if this is a witch hunt and a hoax and he says he has nothing to hide, then why doesn't he just release his records and let people see it for themselves?
You know, Paul, that's one of the early lessons I got as a young reporter covering Watergate for Newsweek magazine many years ago. One of the cardinal rules of political damage control seems to be, if you don't have anything to hide, why behave like you do? And there's been lots of presidents, including Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, who was not a president, but the Clintons always behaved often like they had something to hide, whether they did or not. And that I think, is the problem here for President Trump. The Supreme Court is clearly torn. This is a political year, and they will make a ruling. They have to make a ruling. They will make a ruling in June before they adjourn this term of the court, and that'll be before the election. So I think the Supreme Court's being even more careful. And I'm not a scholar, a legal scholar. I'm guessing the Supreme Court is going to reject the notion of the Trump lawyers that as a president, one has absolute immunity from civil or criminal proceedings. Period. End of conversation. That the president basically is omnipotent. I think they're going to throw that part of it out. But then the question of, as Kimberly says, where is the balance? I suspect they will try to find a balance in this hottest of hot potatoes in a active political election year. They're going to try to split the difference here somehow, and it'll be fascinating to see how they do that.
Well, even if somehow they determine that Congress can subpoena the president to turn over these records, that certainly doesn't mean that the president will do that. I mean, we, in fact, may be kind of just going down a blind alley here. And no matter what they rule, nothing could happen between now and November. Is that a reasonable assessment, Kimberly?
Well, I think we've had so many unprecedented incidents in this presidency. It'd be hard to predict what the president will or will not do at this point. However, I think it's worth noting that one of the ways lawyers, especially in New York, have tried to get at the president's records is by going to his banks and asking for tax documents and other financial documents from the bank. So even if the president of the United States rejects a Supreme Court ruling that would require him to turn over his tax returns, which I honestly am also not a judicial scholar, I have no idea what would happen then. I don't think that major banks would be willing to do the same thing.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week. Our thanks to Kimberly Adams, correspondent for Marketplace, and Tom DeFrank. He's contributing editor to National Journal. This program is produced by The Voice of America. I'm Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports, Dow Jones and USA Today. Thanks very much for listening.